Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jonathan Brader of the Brennan Center for Justice, who assesses the Supreme Court's recent ruling that allows the state of Ohio to substantially reduce early voting hours in this November's midterm election. Ted Glick of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, who talks about growing opposition to a planned liquefied natural gas export terminal in Maryland and others across the nation. And Peter Hart of the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who takes a critical look at corporate media's coverage of America's new war in Iraq and Syria. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Pakistan predicts a record number of polio cases as the Taliban and Islamist fighters have branded polio campaigns as part of a sinister Western plot. Since 2012, 60 public health workers and security personnel have been killed by Taliban and Islamist militants in Pakistan's northern tribal areas. Public health campaigns were targeted in Pakistan after it was revealed that the CIA had used a hepatitis B vaccination program in the city of Abbottabad as a front for trying to track down al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, later killed by U.S. Special Forces in 2011. Today, Pakistan is a global hotspot for the spread of polio. The situation has deteriorated to the point where Pakistan began enforcing a World Health Organization recommendation in June that requires anyone traveling overseas from Pakistan to produce proof that they had received a polio vaccination. Polio has deformed, paralyzed, and killed people for centuries. Large epidemics in the 20th century killed hundreds of thousands of children. The polio vaccine was developed in the 1950s, and up until recent years, the virus had effectively been eradicated in much of the developing world. Outraged that Fidel Castro had deployed Cuban troops to Angola in the mid-1970s, then U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger threatened to launch a full-scale military attack against the communist island nation. The attack plans drawn up in the waning days of the Ford administration were never advanced due to Jimmy Carter's victory in the 1976 presidential election, after which the Carter administration sought to ease tensions with Fidel Castro. According to a presidential transcript obtained by the National Security Archive, Kissinger told Ford in 1976, "I think sooner or later we are going to have to crack the Cubans." The Cuba attack plan is disclosed in a new book titled Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden Negotiations Between Washington and Havana, written by Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive and William Leogrand, a professor of government at American University. The book explains that Mr. Kissinger, who was Secretary of State from 1973 to 1977, had previously planned a covert effort to normalize relations with Cuba. But those plans were scrapped in late 1975 after Mr. Castro deployed troops to Angola to help the newly independent nation defend itself against South Africa and U.S.-backed right-wing rebels. Bank of America has a sweetheart deal with New York City's Metropolitan Correction Center, where the financial giant has monopoly control over money transfer services, electronic messaging, and some inmate phone services. Bank of America similarly dominates all the facilities run by the U.S. Bureau of Prisons, which holds over 200,000 inmates in federal prisons. Since 2000, Bank of America has collected at least $73.3 million for its work in prison programs. When federal inmates are released, they are given high-fee payment cards issued by JPMorgan Chase that distributes all earnings from prison accounts, including meager earnings from jobs and funds sent by family and friends. According to the Center for Public Integrity, these contracts, drawn up by the U.S. Treasury Department, utilize a 150-year-old authority to bypass standard oversight, transparency, and competition typically required for federal contracting, an arrangement that competitors in the finance business have thus far been unable to overturn. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
In a 5-4 ruling on September 29th, the U.S. Supreme Court effectively blocked the start of early voting in the state of Ohio, reversing an earlier federal appeals court decision that had prevented the state from reducing days allotted for early voting from 35 to 28 days. The lower court had also mandated Ohio restore some evening and Sunday voting that the state legislature had removed. Although the Supreme Court's decision is temporary until a full ruling can be rendered, the reduction in voting hours will be enforced for this year's midterm election on November 4th. The High Court's ruling could affect voting laws in Arkansas, North Carolina, Texas, and Wisconsin, where GOP-controlled legislatures have passed laws reducing early voting, imposed new burdensome voter ID requirements, and restricted registration drives. While Republican lawmakers assert new limits on voting rights have been introduced to prevent voter fraud, independent analysis has found no evidence to support that claim. Civil liberties and civil rights groups have long charged that the drive to make voting more difficult disproportionately affects minority voters and is part of a strategy to gain partisan political advantage. 22 states have passed restrictive voting laws since a wave of Republican Party victories in 2010, and this year's midterm election will be the first time 15 states will enforce their new voting regulations. Your reporter spoke with Jonathan Brader, counsel with the Democracy Program of the Brennan Center for Justice. Here he assesses the Supreme Court's recent ruling on Ohio's voting laws and the effect of GOP efforts nationwide to make it more difficult for citizens to vote in an election year where control of the U.S. Senate is at stake.
The Ohio legislature moved to cut a week of early voting, and including what was referred to in Ohio as Golden Week, which is a time when you could register and vote at the same time. So this is obviously very important for voter mobilization efforts. Early voting in Ohio was also something in recent years that a lot of minority voters had taken advantage of, especially the Sunday before Election Day. It was a very popular opportunity for things like Souls to the Polls drives, which are very popular, for example, in African-American churches. After the Ohio legislature moved to cut a week of early voting, the federal court had held that the cut to early voting would have to be blocked because of some of the harmful effects it might have, particularly on minority voters. And right before that restored week of early voting was about to begin, the Supreme Court, without an opinion, just reversed it. So as of now, that early voting week is not available. In terms of the nationwide picture, I mean, this Ohio case is just one of a number of ongoing court battles that really could shape what the voting landscape looks like. And there's also ongoing lawsuits in Texas, Wisconsin, North Carolina, a case involving Kansas and Arizona. So even though we're only a few weeks out from this midterm election, there's a lot of moving parts, and we're not sure what kind of landscape voters are going to face in a lot of these states.
Jonathan, since 2010, Republican-controlled state legislators around the country have passed bills to limit early voting, impose new obstacles to voter registration, and restrictive voter ID laws. I wonder if you could review for our listeners the net effect that these laws may have on disenfranchising, and particularly minority voters, in this coming election. I know there's been some studies about how these laws will affect turnout in the next election and how that could actually change the outcome of some contests state by state.
When these laws first passed, sort of in a lead up to the 2012 election, we estimated at that time that up to 5 million Americans could have a harder time voting because of these restrictions. And because of the ongoing litigation and because of some changes in state laws, we don't know exactly what the effect will be for this election. But some of the figures we've seen from some of these lawsuits suggest it could be a pretty serious effect. For example, in Texas, where we're currently challenging their voter ID law in court, the evidence showed that 1.2 million Texans don't have the ID that's needed by this law. And that includes 600,000 registered voters. And the impacts don't fall evenly. Hispanic voters are more than three times likely to not have that ID in Texas. Black voters are more than twice as likely not to have that ID when compared with whites. And, you know, that's just one example. If you look at some of the other restrictions, like cutting back on early voting, the sort of the backlash against early voting is something that's happened, particularly in the South and the Midwest, after African Americans started using early voting at higher rates. And so we've seen, for example, in states like Florida, after African Americans and Latinos use early voting at higher rates, the legislature is moving to cut that. Another example is cutting back on voter registration drives. Voter registration drives drives by groups like the League of Women Voters, Rock the Vote, other organizations are very important for, and have been very important for, closing the registration gap between, you know, racial groups. And so we've also seen states moving to make those registration drives harder. So there's a whole variety of ways that some of these restrictions are not falling evenly in terms of their impacts across racial lines.
In your view, what is the antidote to all these states really setting up an uneven playing field for voters, where in one state it's going to be a lot more difficult to vote than in a state next door? It just seems like we have a horrible mess in terms of voting rights in this country at the moment. Is federal legislation possible to create some basic standards or a threshold to make sure the largest number of people can get to the polls without obstruction?
I think that there are a couple ways to fix it. And one is, we definitely do need action at the federal level. First of all, Congress has to act to restore the Voting Rights Act. The way the Supreme Court has gutted the law, it's going to take congressional action to basically fix Section 5 to restore this key civil rights protection. There are also some just common sense reforms that can be put in place at the federal level. A bipartisan panel that had Obama and Romney's top election lawyers recommended a lot of common sense fixes, including things like modernizing voter registration that Congress can act to put in place for federal elections. So that's definitely one way to address the problem. Another thing we've seen that's actually very encouraging is that a lot of states are passing positive laws, including laws that modernize registration, some states expanding early voting and putting other pro-voter reforms in place. So one thing that people should definitely do is push for pro-voter reforms in the states. And then we've also just seen voters really do push back against these things. In 2011, for example, when legislators tried to cut election day registration in Maine, there was a ballot initiative to overturn that. We've seen in North Carolina, where there was a harsh and sweeping registration restriction, there's been a huge uprising, including the Moral Mondays movement that have been talking about these election issues extensively. And there's been a big voter engagement push. So one thing to really keep in mind is that, you know, if politicians are passing these unfair voting laws and trying to manipulate the system, the answer is to understand the rules in your state, make sure you're registered, make sure you show up and vote, and help other people do the same.
That was Jonathan Brader, counsel with the Democracy Program of the Brennan Center for Justice. For more news and commentary on groups challenging discriminatory voter suppression laws, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On September 29th, FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, approved the construction of a liquefied natural gas, or LNG, export terminal at Cove Point, Maryland, in the town of Lusby on Chesapeake Bay. The facility was originally built to import natural gas, but since the boom of horizontal hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, which extracts gas from tight shale rock formations over the last decade, the U.S. is awash in the fossil fuel, and the industry is looking to sell it abroad. Energy business observers say that the construction of export terminals will greatly accelerate fracking in the nearby Marcellus Shale, which covers regions of New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Virginia, and West Virginia. Environmental activists warn that the fracking extraction method results in a large increase in carbon emissions that cause climate change, as well as endangering local communities that have experienced both air and water pollution. A legal protest followed by a civil disobedience action briefly shut down FERC's offices in Washington, D.C. in July. Now a broad coalition of groups and individuals are planning a week of protests at the agency the first week of November. Opponents charge that FERC, which operates independently of the federal government, narrowly serves the interests of the energy industry it was established to regulate by acting as a rubber stamp for natural gas projects. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Ted Glick, National Campaign Coordinator with the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. He says opponents are organizing the protest as they appeal FERC's decision on the Cove Point LNG terminal, which is just one of more than a dozen such terminals seeking federal approval for construction across the U.S.
And there are many groups that will continue to fight to try to change this decision, as well as to prevent the building of additional export terminals. There are 13 other proposed export terminals that FERC is dealing with right now. They have now approved four of them. This is part of a huge plan to just to tremendously expand the fracked gas industry in the United States and to move it worldwide.
So Cove Point was originally built as a gas import terminal before fracking produced so much gas domestically, right?
Right. It was actually built in the 1970s as an import terminal. It was sold to Dominion about 10 years ago, again, as an import terminal. But the planned expansion of imports via that particular site at Cove Point did not pan out because, again, of the rise of fracking, essentially, particularly in the Marcellus region, in the Marcellus Shale region. And this Cove Point facility would be an outlet for much of the frack gas that would continue to be brought out of the ground and actually expanded. There would be a big expansion of fracking to meet both the domestic demand for natural gas as well as this international demand for it.
Ted Glick, I've been to southern Louisiana, which is covered with all kinds of oil and gas infrastructure. It's a sacrifice zone to that industry, and it's also known as Cancer Alley. That happens to be where one of the approved export terminals is farthest along. But the area around Cove Point is totally different, right?
The import facility that exists now, it's within a community, you know, the community of Cove Point. The greater area, it's the town of Lusby, Maryland, and I believe the figure is that something like 2,500 people live within 1 mile of this facility, and there definitely are real dangers living close to a natural gas facility like this one. The processes that have to be undertaken to change the gas to a liquid, they need to take the gas that comes in from the Marcellus Shale region, particularly Pennsylvania. If this would come to fruition, if they would build it and it starts to work, they would need to liquefy the gas to a liquid to put it onto these tankers and to ship it overseas. That's a very energy-intensive process. They need to bring the temperature of the gas down to something like minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit in order for it to turn into a liquid. Just the whole process is dangerous. Natural gas, definitely something that can catch on fire, can explode. And to have something like this built right within this neighborhood of hundreds of homes, within the blast radius, essentially, of a major accident there is just crazy. It really is crazy. We don't think that there is any other export terminal or maybe even any import terminal anywhere in the world that is built right in the middle of a neighborhood the way this one is.
A local commission changed the rules or gave the company a pass in order to facilitate Dominion's project. Can you talk about that?
Yes, the county commissioners essentially exempted this one entity from any of the regulations governing industrial facilities for that county. And a county judge, ruled that was unconstitutional, that a county commission could not kind of pick and choose, you know, this entity doesn't have to, you know, abide by zoning regulations that other industries do. So that has not yet been fully litigated in terms of what that decision of that county judge, that what the county commissioners did was unconstitutional according to the Maryland Constitution. How that matches up with the FERC decision, the federal agency that Dominion can go ahead and start building this. The background, though, of FERC is that they essentially overrule local jurisdictions, so that is probably what's going to happen. But it's not. Actually the Court of Appeals, the Federal Court of Appeals in D.C., in Washington, D.C., that will likely be hearing the appeal of the FERC approval eventually. They made a pretty good decision. This was maybe about 6 months ago for a pipeline coming across from Pennsylvania and New Jersey into the New York area. They ruled that FERC had illegally segmented the pipeline into different 50-mile segments, even though it was essentially the same pipeline. It all connected together. That was a way to try to hide and to try to obfuscate the overall impact of the thing, kind of the cumulative impacts of building something like this on local areas, on forests where the pipeline went through, on rivers that the pipeline went through, and the danger of leaks and so on. So there have been some court decisions in the last couple of years that are going more our way, and that's hopeful in terms of what is likely to end up happening for sure in terms of this Cove Point decision.
That was Ted Glick, National Campaign Coordinator with the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. Find more information on the planned protest and related material on groups opposed to natural gas fracking across the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Thank you. after President Obama announced his decision to expand the U.S. war against ISIS from Iraq to Syria on September 22nd. American and Gulf State warplanes launched dozens of airstrikes targeting the militant Sunni group inside Syria's borders. But according to Kurdish forces defending the northern Syrian city of Kobani, located in a strategic position on the Turkish frontier, the U.S.-led bombing campaign was having little effect on the forward advance of ISIS fighters. Since ISIS extended their control to wide swaths of territory in Iraq from their strongholds in Syria during the summer, a succession of U.S. politicians and commentators have been featured in corporate media criticizing President Obama for not taking more rapid and aggressive military action to counter the terrorist group. Now that the administration is fully engaged in an air war against ISIS, there is a growing chorus of critics who assert that airstrikes are not enough and that ground forces must be deployed to accomplish the president's stated goal of degrading and destroying ISIS. Public opinion has shifted significantly from last year, when a strong majority of Americans were opposed to President Obama's plan to bomb Syrian government forces following charges that Bashar al-Assad's regime had used chemical weapons against rebel groups and civilians. The broadcast of a series of gruesome video clips of an ISIS executioner beheading U.S. and British journalists and aid workers undoubtedly played a role in reshaping public sentiment. Your reporter spoke with Peter Hart, activism director with the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. Here, Hart takes a critical look at corporate media's coverage of the new U.S. war in Iraq and Syria.
A lot of the patterns are absolutely familiar to anyone who's watched how media perform in really any modern war, going back to the CNN Gulf War, going back to the Panama invasion even. You have the identification of a supremely awful enemy. In some cases, the tag fits. In other cases, maybe less so. You have this array of pro-war voices pounding the desks, demanding action. Very little debate when it comes to the quote-unquote debate shows or the debate formats, the roundtables and so forth. You have, once war gets underway, the kind of sanitized, obviously nothing can go wrong, precision bomb type coverage that we're seeing now, to the extent that the war is even being covered right now. But you have all of these elements right now that are, or at least in the last couple of weeks, that are very familiar because I think media perform exactly the same function every time. So it's not going to change. What's going to change are some of the particulars about why we're going to war. And in that area, I think the questions you need to ask about the coverage are a little bit different. You know, this isn't an Iraq WMDs type scenario where it was so obvious that the administration was selling a line. This is one where we are really seeing the collision of two lines of propaganda, so that coming from the Islamic State, these kind of gaudy, slickly produced videotapes that are intended to excite their followers and excite their enemies at the same time, to provoke a reaction or an overreaction from the United States or from other Western powers. We have that line of propaganda, which includes obviously these disgusting beheading videos, and the propaganda that it meets, which is the U.S. media's. So if the purpose of the Islamic State's propaganda arm is to provoke a reaction in political circles and in media circles to make their cause the number one story in the country and perhaps the world, then they're absolutely doing a fantastic job of it. And the only way they can do that is if the U.S. media play along and decide that any statement from this group, any outlandish video, even if CNN is not airing it in full, and obviously they're not, by focusing so much attention on it and by giving people a debate that is basically between two politicians, one of whom wants to bomb now and one of whom wants to bomb now and bomb harder than the first one, well, that's sort of a recipe for disaster, and I think that's what we're seeing in the coverage right now. So you have a lot of the elements that I think are very familiar to anyone who's studied war coverage, but this one, of course, like maybe every other one, has its own peculiar features as well.
And you would think that after the deception that was successful in terms of getting the United States into a war in Iraq back in 2003 under the Bush administration on false pretenses, the false WMD, to justify the war, that with that recent history, you would think the U.S. corporate media would be a bit more skeptical of the reasons that the United States should undertake a new war in Iraq. But have you seen any glimmer of hope that there's room for skepticism on these cable and broadcast TV shows in particular?
Well, I think the questions you have to ask are a little bit different. You know, so in the case of ISIS or ISIL, the charge that came out, I think, most clearly in some of the coverage around the videos was, can they do damage to the U.S. quote-unquote homeland? Is that their intent, and can they do it in short order? Because if they can, then we must respond militarily, so the theory goes. And you did see some coverage that took issue with the political rhetoric, and even from Obama himself. He was saying, you know, we don't see evidence of an active plot right now, and that's really not the point. But you saw so much conversation that treated ISIS as if they were bound to have fighters at the U.S. border any second now. Some of it on mainstream media, you know, this wasn't a Fox News type story. I watched it on ABC probably a month ago, that they had intelligence officials warning them that ISIS posed this clear and imminent threat to the United States. So you did see some pushback on that. I think the criticism of the media performance has to come from a slightly different angle. I think the lesson that should be learned, if any is learned at all, is that the application of massive violence does not produce the political outcomes that the United States government says it is seeking in any of these places. So you cannot find an example of this working in any of the most recent scenarios we're talking about. You cannot point to Afghanistan and say the massive violence that was inflicted on an already suffering country by the United States military has produced a better outcome for Afghanistan. You certainly cannot say that in Iraq right now. So when they point to the past to justify the present military interventions or bombing campaigns, you have to ask yourself, why is there automatically an assumption? No one even argues about this. There is just an assumption that this is going to produce some kind of outcome that we can kind of hang our hats on.
That was Peter Hart, activism director with the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Find more analysis of media coverage of America's newest war by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.